Robert Warshaw died in the spring of 1955. I'm quoting here. He was 37 years old. In the circle of his friends, the shock of his death was extreme. I have never known a death so intensely and openly grieved over. No one was inclined in the modern way to accept it. No one was reasonable or philosophical about it. It did not seem a fact in nature, but against nature. Now, this is how Lionel Trilling introduces a book called The Immediate Experience, and I highly commend it to you. This is the book in paperback put out not so long ago by Harvard University Press. And it contains most of the essays that Robert Warshaw wrote between 1946 and 1955. Many things contributed to the grief surrounding Warshaw's death. In the intellectual circles around Commentary and Partisan Review, he was the first and the youngest to die, cruelly interrupting a rising career when he was just finishing the manuscript for his first book. Then he left a young son to whom he had been exceptionally devoted. And Warshaw had also been an editor at Commentary for 8 years under the very difficult editor-in-chief, Elliot Cohn. It was said that Warshaw was Cohn's steadying hand, and his loss was certainly felt at the magazine. Perhaps not entirely for that reason, but certainly in some connection, Cohn committed suicide in 1959. That was not the high point of Commentary. But I begin with Trilling's description of bereavement because some of us continue to feel that sense of bereavement. I've known many readers, including students, who discover this book and can't believe that Warshaw is not around to keep providing more essays. Now, Bob Warshaw was born in 1917, the only child of a second marriage. He grew up in New York, went to college and graduate school at the University of Michigan, where he got his master's degree in English. During the war, he worked as a code breaker for the Army Signal Corps. And after the war, he became this editor at Commentary. He published most of his essays there and in Partisan Review. And after college, he entered into a happy marriage with a schoolmate, Edith Folkoff, and their son Paul was born in 1943. However, his wife developed multiple sclerosis when she was very young. She became severely disabled, so that he became her caretaker and something like a single parent to his son. Now, so not a very long life, certainly, and not a very easy one. Most of what we know about the quality of Warshaw's upbringing, we learn from a marvelous essay that he wrote in 1951 on the death of his father. He writes, he, his father, belonged to the socialist movement as one belongs to a certain city or a certain neighborhood, and that must have been also the cultural atmosphere of the home. The essay is tender, but one senses the son's regret that his father had been an atheist who wrote a will asking to be cremated in order to express his rationalist disbelief. When the father was asked what should be done with the ashes, he said, throw them in the ash can. It left Warshaw, I think, hungry for much more. In 1949, Midge Dechter, whom actually we're going to be speaking about next month, began working at Commentary at Warshaw's secretary. In a wonderful remembrance of him and his work, Commentary, April 2002, she cites his generosity. He would sometimes jokingly complain that if he could only learn to keep his mouth shut, he might not then end up so frequently having to cite his own ideas from the works of others who had appropriated them. Well, this says something about the camaraderie of that office. We've emphasized the intellectual's belief in the power of ideas. Well, while Delmore Schwartz, whom we spoke of, channeled his ideas through poetry and fiction, Warshaw looked for the clearest, most direct form of saying in essays whatever he found important to say on politics, on the intersection of literature and politics, on theater, books, comic books, and the movies. Norman Podhoretz calls him one of the best essayists in the English language, and one of the least appreciated. So in a modest way, we hope to change that. What keeps Warshaw on the college curriculum today are mostly his writings on the movies. And here is a well-known passage. "I have gone to the movies constantly, and at times almost compulsively for most of my life. I should be embarrassed to attempt an estimate of how many movies I've seen and how many hours they have consumed. At the same time, I've had enough interest in the products of the higher arts to be very sharply aware that the impulse which leads me to a Humphrey Bogart movie has little in common with the impulse that leads me to the novels of Henry James or the poetry of T.S. Eliot. That there is a connection between the two impulses, I do not doubt, but the connection is not adequately summed up in the statement that the Bogart movie and the Eliot poem are both forms of art. To define that connection seems to me one of the tasks of film criticism, and the definition must be, first of all, a personal one. A man watches a movie, and the critic must acknowledge that he is that man." This statement is less about how we see films than about the responsibility of the intellectual. The same person who appreciates Humphrey Bogart and T.S. Eliot and makes connections between one and the other must, according to him, also see the difference between the movies and modernist poetry. That same man watching Bogart and reading Eliot should not pretend that the two experiences are alike just because he is bringing the same critical intelligence to bear on both. That critic has to apply his intelligence to differentiating the quality of both experience and trying to evaluate each in its own terms, because both call for serious evaluation. And that's exactly what Warshaw did. He thought as seriously about the movies as he did about Kafka, without ever pretending that they were equal aesthetic experiences. Now, why was all that so important? I think there are several reasons that it is so important, and were certainly so important to him. One is that American culture is not hierarchical, like the culture of England, where you could instantly differentiate between Liza Doolittle and Professor Higgins, between the graduates of Oxbridge and the rest of the population. The built-in class structure of England naturally included cultural distinctions between high brow and low brow, certainly between the elite and the street. And My Fair Lady satirizes this snobbery while confirming how much it persists. Class distinctions ran very deep in the Bloomsbury circle of Virginia Woolf and E.M. Forster and others, to which the New York intellectuals were most often compared. Bloomsbury did not apply its intelligence to popular culture. By contrast, America was so classless that these, quote, "somewhat grubby and ill-mannered Jews," as William Barrett lovingly describes them, could compete on equal footing with Bloomsbury and form their own, I would say, improved version of it. As we've seen, Delmore Schwartz was ready to pit himself against T.S. Eliot, but at the same time, they extended the notion of culture to include mass culture, like the movies. Popular entertainment was not harmful in itself. It was good or bad, depending on how true it was to human actuality, how coarsely or sensitively it manipulated the emotions, and whether it enhanced or diminished the human spirit. For Robert Warshaw, it wasn't a matter of class or snobbery or level of intelligence. He was worried about the effect that mass culture could have on coarsening a democracy. If I'm not mistaken, and here I am out on a limb, he was after something like the Jewish distinction between grob and edel. Now, in my upbringing, there was no distinction that was as important or as firm as this distinction between coarse, grob, and refined, edel. Learning was one component of refinement, one way of forming the cultivated individual, but learning alone did not guarantee sensitivity or the necessary distinction of character. The refined person was one in whom all the values of Jewish law and custom were effortlessly present. And I think this is what the British call breeding. Right? Well, without explicit reference to Jewish tradition, Warshaw was after something like it in the cultivation of American culture. Democracy was a good thing, but culture for the masses could also be more easily manipulated by the more advanced sectors. He wanted the thoroughly well-cultivated American to bring the same discriminating consciousness to bear on all parts of experience and all levels of culture. A film for the masses could be refined or vulgar, true or false in its own terms. The critic in a democracy had to help cultivate this distinction. And that, in fact, was, I think, what he saw as being the task of the intellectual. And the intellectual in his case, and not only in his case, was mostly the person who wrote criticism, taking criticism really as a very, very high calling. Now, what also made it very important, and here we come to the topic which has brought many people out here, the penetration of communism is what made this urgent. In The Legacy of the 30s, one of the assigned readings, Warshaw shows how communism extended way beyond direct Soviet influence. Just when Western civilization had thought that despotism could no longer rule over subject populations, and when constitutional democracy might guarantee freedom and rights for all, along comes a revolutionary movement that establishes a more insidious tyranny and does it in the name of progress, equality. I say more insidious because this political movement controls thought, not just behavior. Superseding religion in the name of universal reason and claiming to be the historically determined good, it forbids all competing ideas of authority and uses mass media to spread its universal message. Communist doctrine was evil not only because Stalin murdered people in its name, but because it used democratic culture to substitute slogans for thought, lies for truth, and it leveled human experience in the process. And this I am channeling Warshaw in saying this. Warshaw felt that he and his cohort came of age when, quote, virtually all intellectual vitality was derived in one way or another from the Communist Party. And if you were not in its orbit, you had to expend your energies in the opposition, which still meant that you were in its orbit. We may object that he was actually speaking for only part of America, but it was the part that influenced every other. To be for Trotsky and against Stalin was no intellectual or moral saving grace. He writes, much more was required than just to be anti-Stalinist. The culture remained and spread and entrenched itself, and its mere existence, this climate in which one had to live, was a standing threat to one's personality, was in a sense a deep personal humiliation. Communism subordinated the judgment of the individual to something allegedly higher, the directives of the party, on the grounds that individualism was itself a bourgeois indulgence. And he writes, for the serious intellectual, something more than an error of taste, of judgment, was involved when he accepted the pretensions of proletarian literature, or when he assented to the general opinion that Bury the Dead was a vital work of art, or when he rejected the work of Henry James because it was outside the mainstream of American tradition. The very possibility of these errors and of 1,000 others like them represented at bottom a fatal acquiescence, a kind of willing mortification of the self. It meant that judgment was no longer free, or at least that there were considerations more important than free judgment. Now, Bury the Dead was a communist propaganda play written by Erwin Shaw in 1936 to promote pacifism in America at a time when Stalin and Hitler were planning to take over the world, each believing that he could conscript the other for his own aims. America was to be made to feel guilty about its military capability, hence a play about pacifism, right? So that the Soviet ideal could gain an advantage. The communists used popular American entertainment to make Americans despise their country. And if you could no longer distinguish between a subtle masterpiece by Henry James and a coarsening indoctrination play by a communist hack, how could you maintain an open democracy that expected citizens to think and decide for themselves? So first, egalitarianism persuaded you that there was no difference between propaganda and masterful art. And if you then noticed the difference, it congratulated you for ignoring it, because by embracing a culture of the masses, you were repairing the world. You were building a better future. So in this description of communist influence, Warshaw, this is interesting to me, inadvertently reveals more than he knows. If you read the essay, you see that he uses the phrase uncorrupted radicalism to describe the protests in the 1920s in the case of two Italian-born anarchists, Sacco and Vanzetti, who were tried for armed robbery and the murder of two payroll clerks, and they were executed in 1927 after a long legal battle. Protesters at the time accused the American courts of falsely prosecuting these men because they were Italian immigrants and anarchists. And Warshaw assumes that the demonstrations back then were spontaneous and genuine. He was then a child, and he never went back to investigate that historical moment. But actually, the Soviet Union orchestrated the Sacco-Vanzetti campaign in Europe, in the United States, and very heavily in the Yiddish press, which is how I come to know how heavily they manipulated this. And they did it every bit as thoroughly as they did the later ones. Writing this in 1947, he had no idea of the role that the Comintern had actually played in stoking those earlier fires of rage. But what Warshaw didn't know about the 1920s, he does know about the 1930s. American liberties, as we said, were being exploited to promote distrust in America by comparing the so-called justice in Russia as a result of enforced egalitarianism to the alleged injustice of America thanks to its so-called freedoms. Over there was a system less and less open to scrutiny, since a totalitarian system can control information at will. Communists used American injustice, like the trials of the nine black Scottsboro boys in the years between 1931 and 1937, and used the economic depression to prove the rottenness and corruption of the democratic system. And after a time, there were people who had never known any other intellectual climate. And then, intermeshed with the needs of democratic culture and these dangers of communist influence, was the question of where the Jews belonged in all this. In England, acquiring culture was one way of rising in the class structure, though it didn't guarantee acceptance. What about America? On what basis were these young Jews supposed to enter Anglo-American culture? For Lionel Trilling, the matter became straightforward once he wanted to teach at Columbia University. He had to prove that he could master and interpret literature at the highest level. The dissertation that he wrote on Matthew Arnold was so good that it persuaded the president of Columbia University to hire him as the first Jew in the English department. He, of course, became a superior literary critic and teacher of the Western canon. But Warshaw sees what the self-adaptation cost his friend when it came to writing fiction. Now, Middle of the Journey is a splendid novel of ideas. And if this were actually a course, it would be the first book that I would have assigned. And I would have very much looked forward to discussing it with such a group. Trilling's novel actually describes how deeply Stalinism penetrated parts of America and how some people succumbed to its pressures and others learned to resist it. Trilling's novel deals with the very same questions that preoccupy Warshaw. But without denying Trilling's achievement, Warshaw identifies as a weakness that we learn nothing about the characters beyond what bears directly on their interaction in the novel. What is missing for him is the Jewish specificity that Trilling shed when entering the Columbia English department. He writes, "The characters exist in a kind of academic void of moral abstractions without a history. Though universalizing Stalinism strictly in the realm of ideas may have highlighted the book's political clarity, the novel as an art form rests on particularity." And Warshaw writes, "Mr. Trilling might have come closer to the essence of the experience he describes if he had been more willing to see it as an experience of particular human beings in a specific situation. Perhaps this means if he had been more willing to face his own relation to it." So you see, in Warshaw's case, it is always a case of making himself, trusting yourself to be the honest interpreter of what it is that you are writing or seeing. So now, to some extent, the absence of this cultural context could be a virtue, because it is honest poverty. This is Warshaw's wonderful description. It is honest poverty, so to speak, as if Mr. Trilling had resolved to make no appeal except to the intelligence or to the emotions, only to the degree that they remain subject to intelligence. This stripping away of anything but ideas makes this an ideal book for discussion. It is so clearly a novel of ideas that you don't feel you have to apologize by reducing it to its ideas, as you would in discussing E.M. Forster's novel, Howard's End, the novel that Warshaw identifies as Trilling's model for his. At the same time, in ignoring context, Trilling does not show how Stalinism offered a way out of the particular psychological difficulties of the middle class and of the Jewish middle class in particular. Since the power of communist influence did not grow in a vacuum, you cannot understand its effect at all without what Trilling left out. What had made communism so appealing to Trilling and his wife and to the circle on which he bases his characters? In other words, he gives you all the discussions about it in the book, but he doesn't show you what was it that had attracted any of these characters to communism in the first place. What features in their upbringing and acculturation had made them susceptible to a system that was so alien to both Judaism and Matthew Arnold? Had Trilling let us know more about these people, we could have learned, for instance, how adopting leftism was a way out of their Jewishness without actual conversion, how coming from Russia predisposed them to seeing the overthrow of Tsarism as a historical inevitability, and so on. The novel that successfully exposes the Stalinist temptation went only halfway because it left out the specific conditions in which it sucked in its victims. Warshaw is afraid that in paring the characters down to only their ideas, Trilling is in a way mirroring what communist culture does in its insistence on what is presumably impersonal, international, and universal. So we go back and forth here. Warshaw is right that ideas do not exist in a vacuum, yet he fails to explain why Trilling actually couldn't have done what comes so naturally to E.M. Forster. Howard's End is a place, apparently based on the place where the author spent his childhood. And the best people in the novel are more deeply attached to a house and a garden than considerations of marriage or children or propriety. Forster is the product of an England that feels it has stood there forever, of people that have been cultivated not only by class, but by landscape and place. The British concept of noblesse oblige has standards of coarse and refined as deep as those in traditional Jewish culture, and they grow from responsibility to property and place, something the American immigrant Jewish community had absolutely no hope of replicating. And here I am reminded of a conference that I once attended at Oxford. We were sitting in one of the courtyards as a groundskeeper was mowing the grass, and one of the Americans in our group asked the groundskeeper, "How can you possibly keep it so extraordinarily lush and green?" To which he replied, "You just water it twice a week and mow it once a week, and you do that for 400 years. So Forster's novel grows out of a similar cultivation, and it suffers from exactly the opposite difficulty. When Forster feels obliged to bring someone of the lower classes into the novel because they were becoming part of modern England, the class divide is so great that he has to interweave an office clerk into the plot quite artificially, so that you can actually see the author pulling the strings, because there is no natural way for the lower class to interact culturally with the upper class. And if you do it in an English novel, you just have to twist the plot in order to make it happen. But for Trilling, it's the reverse. The Jews who were recent transplants to America don't grow out of the landscape. What democratized them was the life of the mind, and that's where Trilling's novel has the advantage. But the whole substance of Jewish life and culture had to be expunged in order to get to that essence of ideas. So, though Warshaw does not polemicize, this essay forcefully expresses his grief over the effect that communism had, even on fellow intellectuals, he thinks, like himself, and on Trilling. He would have wanted that novel to show in depth how communism seduced the Jews by promising them something presumably higher, and how that yearning that may have been genuine for something higher, led them down a mean and murderous road. The socialism of Warsaw's father had led his father to consign his ashes to an ash can, and Warshaw saw communism doing the same thing to Jewish life, actually to all America, but maybe to the Jews in particular. Now, the idealism of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, the essay of 1953, and it's of course their pictures that are here for this evening, that essay was written 6 years after the earlier essay in 1953, and it hones in on much more of the damage. Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, as some of you, I'm sure, know all too well, were both native New Yorkers. Julius was at City College, as a matter of fact, at the same time as Irving Kristol. If you remember, he was in Alcove 2, which was the Stalinist alcove, as opposed to Kristol, who was in Alcove 1, which was the Trotskyist alcove, right? So they both grew out of exactly the same environment. Ethel and Julius were both communists who became part of a spy ring that provided the Soviet Union with top secret information, including about atomic weapon designs. They were arrested in 1950, they were tried in 1951, and executed in June of 1953. Since the case coincided with the war in Korea, they were accused of having put American lives at risk through the information that they had provided. They refused to confess to any wrongdoing, and they continued to maintain their innocence so that they could serve as martyrs of American injustice. And their usefulness in propaganda was probably, I think, much more useful than any secrets that they may have betrayed. And anyway, writing at the time of their execution, Warshaw takes this background for granted. Others raised all kinds of questions about the American system of justice. Should they have been executed? And questions about anti-Semitism. A Jewish judge presided over the trial and sentenced them both to death. So the questions arose. Was he appointed to avoid suspicion of anti-Semitism, and did he sentence them both to death because he was Jewish? Warshaw pays no attention to these things. His exclusive focus is on the minds of the couple, mostly as revealed in the letters that they wrote to one another in prison, obviously letters intended for public consumption and published as part of their campaign. Arthur Koestler, in his novel, Darkness at Noon, tried to understand how a former Bolshevik could be made to confess to a crime he didn't commit in order to keep in power a tyrant whom he hates. He exposes the horrors of the Soviet show trials of 1939. But in the United States, communism was a matter of choice. No one forced the Rosenbergs to become communists, to commit treason, or to lie about it afterwards. If you believed in the power of ideas, you were terrified, not that the Rosenbergs spied, but how they and their defenders thought. What was going on in their minds? So to Warshaw, the exchange of letters between Julius and Ethel Rosenberg shows that their idealism had resulted in the substitution of what ought to be for what is. He doesn't try to get around the problem by saying someone must have written these letters for them. He insists on treating them as human beings with powers of agency. They are parents who obviously love their children, yet they are prepared to leave them orphaned rather than to confess and ask for pardon. It's clear, it was clear to everybody, that had the Rosenbergs confessed and asked for mercy, they would have, of course, been spared. They knew that they were guilty of the crime for which they were accused, but they insisted on their innocence. Warshaw writes, one is forced to wonder whether the literal truth had not in some way ceased to exist for these people. They had yielded to communism's demand that they substitute the truth of the cause for the truth of their experience. If you think the world should be a better place, if you are an idealist, and that your system is making it a better place, what is your life worth compared to that? So having committed yourself to that ideal, how can you renounce it without admitting that you have been duped, that you have collaborated with evil, that you are a villain instead of a martyr? And here I quote Warshaw. Similarly, when Julius Rosenberg says, "It is obvious that I could never commit the crime I stand convicted of," we cannot assume that he is simply lying. More probably, what he means is something like this. If it were a crime, I could not have done it. Since in the language of the unenlightened, what I did is called a crime, and I am forced to speak in that language, the only truthful thing to say is that I did not do it. Warshaw quotes extensively from the letters to demonstrate in this way that they are all written to order. Yet the people writing them are perfectly sincere. They don't have to be ordered to write to order. There is something in this more profound than insincerity. The ideal of the communist responds only to the universal, to revolution, to progress, or in Julius Rosenberg's revealing phrase, to the kind of people we are. Their belief in goodness has long ago pegged itself to an idea beyond themselves, so they can no longer take themselves into account as the touchstone of right and wrong. Now, Warshaw realized that there could be no more desperate problem in maintaining the American way of life than this corruption of thought, this monstrous substitution of communist loyalty for any other. And he was not alone in his concern. The Rosenberg case absorbed all the New York intellectuals, many of whom recognized, I think that they saw, "There but for the grace of God go I." They recognized how close this came to home, having been caught up in the same idealism in their youth. And I'd like here, just in ending, to bring one other example of the New York intellectuals who agonized over the Rosenberg case. This is from the writings of Leslie Fiedler, who happens to be an exact contemporary of Robert Warshaw's, who was born and raised in New Jersey, who also got a degree in literature and went on to teach and to write about it. Although Fiedler had a much longer and very different career, his preoccupation at the time was exactly like Warshaw's. He writes as someone who feels implicated in their defection. In this essay called Afterthoughts on the Rosenbergs, Fiedler claims, that a generation was on trial with the Rosenbergs and with Alger Hiss, the second prominent spy whose case shook up American politics. Fiedler put himself and his generation on trial for failing to expose the guilt of those falsely affirming their innocence. And I find it a little bit interesting, don't you, that Tom Brokaw thinks that this was the greatest generation for defeating fascism, and Fiedler thinks their generation was damned because it succumbed to communism. Very different view of the same set of historical events. So Fiedler begins by looking at how this came to be, one of the most notorious cases in American history. And he distinguishes between the actual case in which the Rosenbergs were tried, found guilty, and executed. Now, he knows they are guilty, but he did not think they should have been executed. This was his opinion. And secondly, the second case manufactured by Soviet propaganda to prove that America was guilty. The second case, and this is the one to which he devotes most of the essay, the second case began as follows, with the communist functionaries who did everything to ensure that clemency would not be granted. The suffering and death of the Rosenbergs, he writes, were willed by the makers of communist opinion and relished by them, as every new lynching in America, every bit of violence against the Jews, is willed and relished as further evidence that they are right. These are the professional accomplices of calamity, and if they cried innocent, it was because they thought that the greatest possibility of disaster lay in such an assertion. So feeding off that small number of professionals was, secondly, the prefabricated public, those for whom the case began when the Communist Party began its agitation. These fellow travelers would have believed the case quite as firmly if there had been no such people as the Rosenbergs, and in a sense, there were not. They were made to serve a purpose and existed only to the extent that they served that purpose, which is, of course, exactly why the Rosenbergs decided to be martyrs in that cause. Then thirdly, there were those who wished them innocent and therefore knew they were. Those who wished them innocence and knew that they were symbolically innocent because they had been acting for a better world. These engaged in double bookkeeping that allowed them to say it's a frame-up, their hearts were pure, and so on. And then some people just wanted them spared. This became difficult because the Soviets made their execution a test of American self-confidence. But then he hones in on exactly the same question that disturbed Warshaw. That the American public should deny the humanity of their enemies is terrible. That the communists should deny the humanity of their comrades, much worse. But that two people should deny their own humanity in the face of death is the ultimate horror, the final revelation of a universal moral calamity. For even at the end, the Rosenbergs were not able to think of themselves as real people, only as cases. If there is a tragedy of the Rosenbergs, this is it. And he too goes into their writings to insist on their actuality, their human existence. He does not say someone wrote these letters for them, because he is lamenting how they could strip themselves of anything meaningful, their Jewishness, of America, of their children, in service to what was essentially Stalin. He writes, a single logic connects the communist hating on order the person he has never seen, the activist ignoring on the street yesterday's best friend who has become a deviationist, the wife leaving her husband the day after he's expelled from the party, the son informing on the father, the accused in Russia slavishly vilifying themselves in court, and the Rosenbergs exploiting their final intimacies to strike a blow in the Cold War. How could they have mistaken this for idealism? So the Rosenbergs and Hiss did not confess their guilt, but Fiedler thinks his intellectual cohort must do so, and he calls for an end to innocence. He writes, "It is not necessary that we liberals be self-flagellants. We have desired good, and we have done some, but we have also done great evil. The confession in itself is nothing, but without the confession, there can be no understanding. And without the understanding, we will not be able to move forward from a liberalism of innocence to a liberalism of responsibility." So by the 50s, our intellectual group was trying to save others from the rotten ideas to which they were once prey. They were determined to move from false innocence to mature responsibility, which meant acknowledging that America is not a rotten country and that Jews were not a reactionary holdover in history. They insisted that independent thought was the only reliable touchstone of truth and that somehow people had once again to think outside communist categories. They knew the future of America depended on it, but how were they going to get it done? And I would just add that it seems to me that these people still had it easy because they could attribute the problem that they were talking about, the problems of political correctness, the problems of this double kind of thinking, they could attribute it to communism. And they could hope that with the defeat of communism, Western civilization would be saved. Crystal's conservatism, you see, began very early on by forcing liberals to confront the evil that they did not want to acknowledge, the war that they did not want to have to fight.